The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
What are you getting so crazy about? It's just music.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kot. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I welcome Canada's indie rock supergroup, the New Pornographers.
And Greg and I will review the new albums by Chris Brown and Damon and Naomi. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
Alors voilà, Clyde a une petite amie. Elle est belle et son prénom c'est
Bonnie.
À eux deux, ils forment le gang Barrow. Leur nom
Bonnie Parker
et Clyde Barrow.
Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde.
This week, Jim, the big news is very troubling, I think, because the war against internet file-sharing piracy has taken another step up. We've got one of the major governments of the world, France, has thrown their weight behind the anti-piracy campaign. They've basically said they have gone into an agreement with internet companies, record companies, filmmakers to shut down file-sharing. They have created an anti-piracy body that is going to basically hunt down who's ever downloading music or movies illegally in France. And if they are caught doing this, they're going to shut them down, basically take away all their access to the internet. I think this is a troubling idea, Jim, because what we've seen so far is these individual corporations going after the consumers, their trade bodies. Now we've got the government involved in France. You know, it's a huge step to say now that France has done it, the United States may end up doing it. But I have to say, it is not a good trend.
Clearly, this is the trend that the content producers, the major labels, would like to see. Have the government be their cop in policing downloading.
Yeah, exactly. I think the parallel to this is what's happening in America with the recording industry going to the universities and actually having the universities do their bidding on this.
Oh, absolutely. So far to date, the Recording Industry Association of America, the trade group of the five major labels, has sent out more than 4,000 threatening letters, threatening lawsuits, and extorting settlements from people who downloaded music at the universities across the country. These have included, you know, a lot of schools, Ohio State University, University of Texas, DePaul University here in Chicago. Until recently, though, like the 10th wave of these lawsuit letters, it hasn't really focused on the Ivy Leagues. Now, in a big way, Yale, Princeton, they're all being sucked into this, all except for one university that is notably absent from the list, and that is Harvard. So 10 waves of lawsuit letters from the RIAA. The one college they haven't gone after yet is Harvard. Why? Well, they say, we're just going after people as we become aware of it, you know. But Harvard has lately been doing a couple of articles about it. They believe that the RIAA is afraid of Harvard because the university, unlike the other colleges, may not pass on those letters to the students. Because remember, you know, the letter goes to the university, and they don't necessarily know who is the owner of that IP address.
Right.
It's just some computer from this university was downloading music. And a lot of those universities have then passed on those letters to the students, regardless of the fact that maybe they were downloading music as part of a research project.
Right.
Isn't that what you're supposed to do at a university? Forget that. So Harvard may not pass on the letter. And also, the Harvard Law School is in a big way against this whole notion. They think that this is a violation. The copyright laws are being read the wrong way. So there's some of the best and brightest legal minds in the country in terms of the professors and the students may well just be itching for an excuse to fight the RIAA.
Yeah, and these pre-litigation letters are basically shakedowns. They're basically saying, pay us $3,000, pay us $4,000, we'll go away. We're going to take away your file sharing. You're going to give us $3,000. It's all good. There's no trial. So most of the universities in the country are participating in this program. It looks like Harvard may be putting up some resistance. There's a footnote here, Jim, with the trade group that is representing this lawsuit campaign, the Recording
Industry
Association of America.
Well, the reason they've had all this clout, it's like the five big mob families out in New York and New Jersey. You know, now they're, you know, they're a mere shadow of what they once were, the Sopranos aside. The RIAA has been increasingly hurt in terms of its clout because the big labels are hurting. They're not selling what they used to sell. And now EMI, one of the world's largest record companies, is apparently threatening to cut its funding to the RIAA. Apparently, each of the big five labels give more than $132 million a year to this organization to do things like sue its own customers, right? And now EMI is saying, well, you know, we're not so sure. Now that it's been bought out by this Terra Firma group for 2.4 billion pounds or almost $5 billion, they're saying, you know, I don't know if this is worth the money. Why are we part of this group?
Yeah. And then, you know, the funding goes away, the RIAA goes away, and then do these lawsuits go away?
Was nobody left to file them, right? Right?
Exactly.
Sprung from cages on Highway 9, chrome wheel, fuel injected, and stepping out over the line. Oh, maybe this town rips the bones from your back. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. We gotta get out while we're young. Cause tramps like us, baby, we were born to run.
Big story in the concert business this week, Jim, is that C3 Presents, the Texas-based company that brought Lollapalooza to Chicago and the Austin City Limits Festival to Austin, Texas, is going to stage a huge festival in the Northeast beginning next summer, the Vineland Music Festival in South New Jersey on a 550-acre farm. They're doing it in tandem with a European promoter, Festival Republic, that has done big festivals like Glastonbury and Reading. So you're combining two huge forces in the concert promotion game to do this big festival in the Northeast. The sidelight to this is that C3 Presents was trying to do this festival in Philadelphia.
Philly. Yeah, downtown Philly, right in the big park.
And local promoter there didn't like what was going on, sought to block that action, and C3 ended up moving its game to South Jersey.
You know, why this is of interest, Greg, is, as we've said a couple times on the show, the entire summer concert industry, which is really when the concert industry makes the bulk of its money every year, is changing in a dramatic way. And I don't think it's for the better. What you're seeing is a new model based on Coachella and Bonnaroo and the C3 festivals, Austin City Limits and Lollapalooza, where, you know, regions of the country sliced up, this corner, that corner, are each getting this big, massive festival, 3 days with 150 bands. And then the whole rest of the summer, because all these festivals have exclusivity agreements, even though the same acts are playing all the same festivals, mm-hmm. right? The acts can't then come back to that market and play a smaller club, which is a preferable way to see them. You're getting the entire concert industry dominated by these festivals. If you don't feel like standing in the sun for 3 days and seeing 150 bands, would rather go see one good band in one nice venue, you're losing the opportunity.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Jim. We've talked about the fact last summer already that there is a glut of these festivals. There might be too many of them. And it's getting to the point where you can't differentiate one festival from the next.
No, they're all the same.
And in fact, Charlie Jones, one of the principals of C3, said there's going to be some overlap between the headliners of Lollapalooza in Chicago on the weekend of August 1 through 3 and this Vineland Festival August 8th through 10th. It's just another big festival in another part of the country, but in terms of the individuality, the type of tone it's going to set, the type of acts it's going to present, it's basically the same festival.
Well, there's really not much difference between Lollapalooza and Austin City Limits at this point in time. I'm surprised they're not calling the South Jersey festival Lollapalooza. You know, they bought that name and made a big deal about how much the brand was worth in this new era of corporate concert. But I think that they realized there'd be a backlash if they suddenly had two Lollapaloozas. My other thought on this, Greg, is clearly this model is coming from Europe, where you've had giant festivals like Reading, Glastonbury, Leeds. There was just an item in the European press a day or two ago where the major beer company that sponsors two of those giant festivals has pulled out and decided it's no longer worth their company. So we're already seeing the waning of the giant European festivals. Now America's trying to copy that. I think they're a little bit behind the ball.
That may be why Festival Republic is trying to break into the American market with this Vineland Festival. And, Jim, another thing. Jones says it's not over yet. He sees another 7 or 8 festivals popping up in the next year or two. He says, yes, we have definitely hit saturation point. There is overload. Not all of these festivals will be here in 5 years. May the best festival win. But I think it's a bad trend. 7 or 8 more festivals. Do we really need that many destination festivals in the United States when we've already got that many now?
No, and I humbly submit that if the best festival is going to win, it's not going to be C3, because to me, it's been the Walmartization of the summer concert experience.
Under your wheels, the hope of spring. Mirage of loss, a few more things. You left your sorrow dangling. It hangs in air like a school cheer. Bump like notes inside the chords. On every wall, inflections carved. Deep as lakes and dark as stars. Remember, we were the volunteers. Newness and nothing more. Now it's my rights versus yours.
You are listening to Sound Opinions, and you're also listening to My Rights versus Yours, a track from the New Pornographers, a band we were pleased to interview a few weeks ago when they stopped by the Jim and Kay Maybe studio. The band was without two of its members, Dan Behar and Nico Case, when they stopped in. But the rest of the band was there. Carl Newman, the primary singer and songwriter, as well as Catherine Calder, John Collins, Kurt Dahl, and Todd Fancy.
There's dangerous levels of it here. Same thing as the other time.
Thank you guys for coming down. Carl, let's talk a little bit about how this band works. I've interviewed you a number of times. We've interviewed Nico. I've talked to Dan Behar. I still don't have a clear idea of how...
You got Dan Behar to do an interview?
Well, you know, when he had the Destroyer record.
Oh.
Did a smattering of press.
And there must have been somebody holding a gun to his head at Merge Records.
It wasn't necessarily
a
revealing interview.
Oh.
this phrase supergroup gets tossed at it all the time. It's the hoariest, tiredest cliche in the world. Everybody in this room is in different bands, right, as well as this one. You make music under numerous guises. My understanding is you're a bunch of friends who come together once in a while to make records together.
Yeah, pretty much. The whole Pornographers thing has kind of gotten out of hand in its way. I mean, we honestly didn't plan to become popular. And so we've just been trying to figure out how to be a band for like 7 years now.
Mm.
So far, so good.
Mm-hmm. The band formed in 97 in Vancouver. You've put out 4 studio records. You said it was just as casual as just getting your friends together in 97, Carl. I mean, was there sort of a vision? Because obviously, pretty sophisticated pop songs that you're writing here, you couldn't just get anybody to play these songs. It's not like a 3-chord punk band kind of approach. It was obviously, there was a little bit more ambition, it seemed to be, even at that point.
Yeah, I think there was some musical ambition there, but that was the only kind of ambition, really. I was really kind of frustrated with my old band, and I wanted to do something else. My old band's on Pano. We hadn't even broken up yet, but I already jumped ship. It was like starting to date somebody else before you've broken up with your old girlfriend.
Now, was that because of the limitations of the band in terms of what they could do musically, or what were the reasons that you wanted to do something different?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes bands suck. I don't know.
Well, you know, I guess what I'm getting at was this sort of like a Jimmy Page thing, you know, where, I'm going to get the best drummer and the best singer and the best bass player, keyboardist that I can find and make this kind of...
Pretty much.
Amazing band. Kind of Vancouver's answer to that, sort of.
Yeah, pretty much, I think. I'm still kind of shocked at how good we became, actually. It's because I don't think we were very good at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But we tried, and we got better.
Well, let's have a song before we get much further into this.
Want to do all the old showstoppers? Okay.
One, two, three, four.
When John needs all the numbers he lied, made up the whole thing, then when he tried to cash in on his cautious new fame, always the number, never the name.
New Pornographers, All the Old Showstoppers from their fourth album, Challengers. Great stuff. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
In the stripped-down acoustic pornography mode.
That's where we're moving.
Are you? It's easier to carry, right?
Yes, it is.
Acoustic instruments.
I'm really getting tired of being a rock band.
Yeah, all those Marshall stacks.
I took a plane, I took a train.
Who cares? You always end up in the city.
Set the car, look up for one.
See just how the sun sets in the sky.
I said to John, do you think the girls here
ever wonder how they got so pretty?
Oh, well, I do.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, more with the New Pornographers.
All the boys with their homemade microphones
have very interesting sounds.
All the girls falling to ruin, dropping out of school, breaking daddy's heart
just to hang around. I walked into the local record store and asked for an American music anthology. It sounds fun.
They tore off my skirt and stuck it on the walls at PS1.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Let's continue our discussion with the New Pornographers.
You spun chalk to interaction there.
Yeah. All right, you were describing a fairly casual process of the band coming together in Vancouver. But with Twin Cinema in 2005, you guys reached the largest audience of your career, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, that record got a lot of attention. It made the Billboard charts, for goodness sake, albeit at like 40 or something.
Hey, we went up 10 on this record.
There you go. Well, that's what I'm saying.
We hit 34.
There are suddenly expectations of this casual group of friends making indie rock records.
Yeah,
people are looking at the band.
Yeah, expectations are bullshit, but that's what we have now.
How do you keep that away from the recording studio when the group gets together?
You just have to, you know. We basically got where we are just by doing what we felt like doing. To suddenly change that and start chasing some kind of success, we have no idea what's going to make us successful. So you just continue and do what you do.
But when we had the Arcade Fire in here, you know, they tried to keep it away from the studio too when they were recording. But there suddenly become practical concerns. There have to be like 300,000 CDs shipped in the first week. And it takes time to like book the pressing plant, you know, and all that stuff that you never thought about when you're just selling CDs out of the back of the van.
They actually concern themselves
with those
things?
Merge Records thoughtfully explained to them that like takes like a long time to make 300,000 CDs. And so you have to give us some idea when this record might be done, guys.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't quite be as casual as it was. I mean, you're playing fairly large venues, selling out multiple nights and cities on this joint. You've played a couple of big festivals here mm-hmm. in Chicago and elsewhere. Gets to become more of an ordeal.
Yes.
Or an endeavor.
Yes, you know, it's an endeavor. / ordeal.
Let's talk a little bit about the songwriting in this band, Carl, because obviously you write plenty of songs. Nico Case is a songwriter who actually doesn't contribute a lot of songs to this band.
No, actually she doesn't at all.
Not at all. And Dan Behar obviously contributes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of balance that? Does Dan just bring songs that he thinks are going to be suited for this band and present them to you, or does he offer you a bunch of songs and you pick out the ones? How does it work with what songs actually end up on the record?
When we first started, I had about an hour-long demo.
The tape.
There's been a few of those tapes where I just cherry-picked songs that I like Wild Homes and Execution Day and Breaking the Law. I remember seeing him play a solo show in like 1999, and he did both Jackie and Testament to Youth in Verse. And mm-hmm. I remember walking up to him and going, "We're going to take those. Those are going to be New Pornographer songs." But after that, I would basically call him up and say, "We need some songs," and he would send them.
Like ordering dinner.
Yeah. And about a month or two after I talked to him, he emailed me Myriad Harbor and Entering White Cecilia, and I thought, these songs are awesome. And that was pretty much it. There have been a few songs of his that he's given that just didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like there's a song that ended up on a Destroyer record called Painter in Your Pocket, mm-hmm. which I just thought sounded too much like Destroyer. I just thought, what could we do with this? I couldn't figure out a way to make it sound like the New Pornographers. So, and that ended up being a great Destroyer song.
What about you personally? I mean, you make records as Carl Newman, mm-hmm. as well as with the New Pornographers, and you tour under that name and with a different band. What's a Carl Newman song versus a song you're going to give to New Pornographers?
You know, at this point, I have no idea.
Mm.
I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, but you had a very clear idea about whether that was a Destroyer song or a New Pornographer song.
That's right.
So you seem to have some kind of idea in your head about what a New Pornographer's sound is.
Yeah, but it's much easier for me to look at Destroyer objectively than it is for me to look at myself and go, what should go on my record?
Mm.
I don't know. I'm actually planning on spending all of the month of January just demoing songs, and I'm going to try and figure out. At the end of January, I should know what's a New Pornographer song and what's a solo song. That's my plan, at least.
The other people in the band? Catherine, can you say to Carl or Dan, for that matter, well, I don't think that's a New Pornographer song? Or how come you're not giving that one to the New Pornographers?
I don't think anyone's ever said that.
No.
It's not allowed.
Not allowed.
Yeah, it'd be a serious breach of etiquette.
Dan. Right, so between the lines, the casualness of the New Pornographers isn't quite as casual as we were initially led to believe.
Yes.
And following up on that, how do you decide Catherine sings, Nico sings, you sing, Dan sings? I mean, how does it get divvied up in terms of who's going to do what?
Sometimes it's a little bit like the way the Cars did it, how Rick Ocasek and Benjamin Orr would both sing lead and just figure out what works best.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's stuff that both, you know, Catherine and Nico sang and just figured out what worked the best, essentially.
You'll have a bunch of people try a song sometimes and figure out who does
or
it best.
That's kind of how the gang vocals end up on songs. It's not all laid out. You just have everybody sing. Like, since you're here, why don't you sing on this? Why don't you sing on this? Why don't you sing on this? And
mm-hmm.
then pretty soon you have, like, the end of Bleeding Heart Show, which has, like, 10 people singing
everybody.
On it.
Yeah.
Not because it was, like, any real intention to have it sound like that. It was just that when you add it all together, it sounds great.
Well, since you bring that song up, my favorite New Pornographer song, by the way. I love that song. And
thank you.
Four-part. I think it's four. There are four distinct parts in that song, right? It's almost like a suite.
Yeah.
Kind of. And it's 4 minutes, four parts. I mean, it's this amazingly... You wrote a prog rock song, basically, but nobody knows that. You know, it's this very complicated kind of song, but yet it sounds very seamless.
I think I've always... you know that song Rosecrans Boulevard by Jimmy Webb? My first band covered
it.
I've always wanted to write a song like that. I just love the way it was only 3 minutes long and just ever, ever expanding.
Rosecrans Boulevard, stop you calling me. You know I never loved her anyway. I just used her.
And constantly changing, but yet not in an annoying prog way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's this great, great song. But I think I've always been chasing that,
mm-hmm.
which it's a dangerous thing to be chasing.
Well, it's a hard thing to do those kind of like little parts within a song and make it appear seamless. Like on the Yes albums, they always seem to announce, you know, this is going to be really difficult. We're playing this 17/8, and it's going to be this, you know, and you'll hear it, and it's really apparent.
Well, there were lots of different things grafted together that didn't belong together.
It was sort of like a Frankenstein kind of thing, but you have this ability to make it sort of seem seamless. I think that's the key.
It's hard. It's hard to make it that seamless.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, is there a secret you can give away about, you know, how do you manage that kind of thing without, you know, drawing attention to the fact that this isn't a traditional pop song. There's four parts in it, and it has these different movements going through it.
I think as long as you put three chords at the end and sing hey la, hey la, people will just forgive whatever happened in the first 3 minutes. You know?
It's true. It's true. You know, Starship Trooper by Yes works all because of that big guitar
riff
at the end. Yeah.
I think you've hit on something.
There's a lot of very easy tricks you can put into to songs.
Why don't you guys play us another tune and tell us what it's going to be?
Okay, this one's called Adventures in Solitude. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Never-ending, the best of the vanished marvels have gathered inside your door. More than begin, but less than forget, both spirits born from the not happened yet, gathering there to pay off a debt brought back from the wars. We thought we lost you.
Beautiful song, Adventures in Solitude, from the new Pornographers record called Challengers. Carl Newman singing with Catherine Calder on that song, and beautiful harmonies. I sort of a melancholy glow to that song. I remember when the reviews of Twin Cinema came out in 2005, they go, wow, what happened to all the exuberant up-tempo songs? They're getting a little darker and a little moodier on this record, and that's carried over into Challengers. So I'll put it to you, Carl, what... do you feel like there's been a little bit of a shift in the way you've been writing the songs and maybe sort of bringing in some of that more melancholy stuff into the songwriting?
Yeah, I mean, you know, nobody wants to keep putting out the same records. over and over again. We could make another record that sounded just like Mass Romantic, but I think it would make me feel very sad inside. Like, I would feel like that was totally selling out. Not that there's anything wrong with making a record like that, but it's just that we already did it. You want to have a body of work that you feel like is somehow relevant. You look at all the good bands through history, they all changed, you know? The Beatles morphed into something very quickly that wasn't She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand. But both of them were great. You look at Meet the Beatles and Sgt. Pepper, and you go, those are both awesome records that bear a little resemblance to each other. And I think that's something to strive for in a band. You know? Like, I think you just have to, like, take risks, basically.
Well, your standards are pretty high, though. I mean, we've talked about this before where, you know, you talk about the kind of songwriters that you've admired, and they're not the typical names that a lot of people in the so-called indie rock world drop. I mean, you're talking about, you just talked about Jimmy Webb and... You'd mentioned your admiration for people like Burt Bacharach before.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson.
Where was...
Everybody loves Brian Wilson in indie rock.
That's true. But you don't hear Burt Bacharach mentioned too much. Where did that appreciation... When did it start and why did it develop? I'm curious.
I remember very clearly when it started. I think it was like spring of 1991. I bought The Best of Dionne Warwick. And I was just floored at how good it was. Like, there were the songs that everybody knows. But then there was other songs like I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself.
I just don't know what to do with myself. Don't know just what to do with myself. I'm so used to doing everything with you.
The entire CD, it really changed me like no other CD. Like, I started doing some piano just because I wanted to be in a band that kind of sounded like Burt Bacharach, which was totally overreaching, and because we weren't capable of doing it, and also completely out of step with the times, because it was like 1991, but...
She made it seem effortless.
And you got to give Hal David a lot of credit, because those lyrics are great. Like, even the cheesy ones. Like, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
Yeah.
Are there any better cheesy lyrics, like, in the history of rock?
That's pretty much as good as cheese gets.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I could write a line like, so I did me some talking to the sun. Said I didn't like the way he got things done, sleeping on the job. Like, that's genius. For somebody who's willing to, like, walk to the edge of the precipice and look down on, like, cheesiness and go, I'm not afraid of you.
Well, did he realize or not, though? It's a question of self-awareness.
I already get mocked enough for that. I don't know why I even say these things out loud.
We've been listening to the New Pornographers here on Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. Thank you so much all for coming down to Sound Opinions.
Thank you for having us.
Raindrops are falling on my head.
To read more about today's show or to listen to the New Pornographers bonus live track, visit soundopinions.org. We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with reviews of Chris Brown and Damon and Naomi's latest.
So I just did me some talking to the sun, and I said I didn't like the way he got things done. He's sleeping on the job, and those raindrops are falling on my head, and they keep falling. But there's one thing I know, the blues they send to greet me won't defeat. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. The cry is not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
You heard it here first. Happy Boy Radio. We love you.
She want that loving, 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 loving. Kiss, 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 kiss. Don't mind, she fantasize.
That's Chris Brown with the number one single in the country called Kiss Kiss. His second album is just out. It's called Exclusive. Chris Brown, who is all of 18 years old now. He's all grown up. Debuted in 2005 when he was only 16 with a self-titled album. Had a huge hit on it called Run It. He's a kid from a small town in Virginia, Tappahannock, and filled that void that Usher left behind.
Yeah, Usher takes so long between albums that Brown's entire career has happened since the last Usher record.
Exactly. Much like Usher, who began his career when he was 14, Chris Brown began his career as a teenager. He's now on his second record. He's sold 3 million records so far. He's got the best producers money can buy on this record. It's a huge release for Jive Records, one of the biggest labels in the R&B field. And what Chris Brown has done is established a persona that's a little closer to that early Usher sound, that kind of innocent boy next door, more so than that lascivious, creepy guy down the street that R. Kelly has established. It's very accessible to a younger audience, and that's who's buying Chris Brown's records. He wants to act all grown up on this record, though, Jim. You notice the difference in the album cover.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot more R. Kelly on this record.
First record had that scowling kid on the cover, dressed in that B-boy outfit. On this cover, he's got the suit and tie on. He's got that suave, self-possessed cool in his face. He wants to present himself as a little bit older, a little bit more mature.
Well, it's the same journey that, you know, Justin Timberlake has taken.
Exactly, and he wants to sell Justin Timberlake-type numbers. Let's see if the music holds up under that scrutiny. Here's a new track from the record called Hold Up from Chris Brown on Sound Opinions.
Line in sync, I knew she was mine. That day I seen they got a big mouth bad on the line. It's time for me to retrieve her and go get her like a wide receiver. But we don't play no ball. See, when it comes to you, baby girl, we don't play at all.
On the real, we need to nip this in the bud, cause we kept it real with everyone. So tell me why they hating.
Everybody's hating.
It feels like they're just waiting
for us to grow.
Hard. This is hard for me to do. But baby, if I'm your man, I guess I gotta be a man. This man just gotta understand.
Little girl,
with curves and hips, luscious lips.
And I can't run now.
I'm nervous.
Hold up, wait a minute. I'm genuine with it. I ain't tryna put no pimping in it. I'm like, hold up.
Can I talk to her? Can I figure out? That's why I gotta tell you now. So crazy out here.
You wanna cut and leave. If your daughter's trust with me, lucky me.
And she be lucky too. No entourage, no crew. Just me riding with my boo.
I got her.
But don't think I'm replacing you.
I know you know what I do. And I'm a major minor. It'll take days and days, decades to find another dude that's gone. In my shoes and go.
Keep it one with you.
If you do the use,
and I'm talking about
hold up.
Wait a minute, I'm genuine with it. I ain't tryna put no pimpin' in it.
I'm like, hold up.
Can I talk to her? Can I figure out? That's why I gotta tell you now.
Can you please hang up the phone? Cause I'm talking to your father. Mr. Jones, I've been talking to your daughter.
And she like me, he told me she like me. And I really like her,
she gon' be my wifey. Can you please hang up the phone? Cause I'm talking to your father. And I really like her. She gon' be my wifey.
And I'm like, hold up.
Wait a minute, I'm genuine with it. I ain't tryna put no pimpin' in it. And I'm like, hold up.
That is Chris Brown with the song Hold Up from his second album exclusive. Greg, you nailed the formula. It's partly the current cutting edge of very slick R&B as personified by Usher at one extreme and R. Kelly at the other. Extreme lyrically. I mean, musically, they have a lot in common. A little bit of hip-hop, a lot of pop, and just a little hint in Brown's case of the go-go funk music that he grew up listening to outside of Washington, D.C. Kind of a throwback to an older, more interesting sound. He made a big deal out of being more mature on this record. I think that that's fine. There's a little bit of that kind of sexist braggadocio and pandering, but there's a sweetness to this guy, and I think the reason we play it Hold Up is that it illustrates that. You know, he's talking to his girlfriend, you know, now, baby, please hang up the phone. I'm talking to your father. Mr. Jones, I've been talking to your daughter, and she likes me. She told me that she likes me, and I really like her. She's going to be my wifey. I mean, it's kind of silly. It's really silly when you just isolate the lyrics, but there's an endearing kind of quality. I really like this record. I think it's a buy-it record.
Well, I like this guy, too. I think the persona is interesting. I think the fact that he isn't
quite as extreme as Kelly is obviously a bonus. The market needs that right now. The R&B market is desperate for that
you
type
can't,
of performer.
You can't push the envelope any further in terms of sexual freakiness than Kelly already has.
And, you know, it's a very smooth sound. The thing is, though, Jim, singers like Usher and singers like Chris Brown are a dime a dozen in R&B. Every male R&B singer worth his salt can hold a note, can stretch it out, can do those melismas, can do all the acrobatics. What really separates the men from the boys in this genre is the production. And on this record, I hear him biting a lot of well-honed formulas.
Oh, yeah.
Other people have done this sound better, including T-Pain. He's got T-Pain on this record. Everybody's got T-Pain on his record.
Yeah.
With that vocoder electronically processed vocal tick
that's
that
become
does.
A big cliche.
That has become a cliche. It's the first single. It's selling because everything T-Pain has put out in the last year and a half has been selling. You've got Lil Wayne. You can't put out an R&B record
without
in the last year and a half without Lil Wayne doing a cameo on it.
No, but see, I think you're
Chris
going down
Brown's
the...
got this one, too. The thing is, Jim, even that song you just played, Hold Up, the chorus of that song, tell me that's not an R. Kelly song.
What's
that
a playground chant is what it is. But you're going down the wrong road. I don't think R&B succeeds or fails on the strength of the producer.
There's no originality here in the production.
It succeeds
it's not
or fails.
Exciting as a production.
It's about
very
the charisma.
Much about formulas.
It's about the charisma of this
he's
kid.
He's got charisma,
he's
but he
star.
Doesn't have any production.
He's in This Christmas right now. He stole the show in Stomp the Yard. He's a movie star. Stole the show at the VMAs, the MTV Video Music Awards, with those dance moves. This guy's a star. He's been groomed to be one since age two.
I think he's going to have a ton of hits on this record. Don't get me wrong. This is exactly what R&B wants right now. It's got all the proven formulas here. But I'm looking. Remember when Usher stepped up with that song, Yeah? I mean, I thought that was a really innovative sound.
I thought that was
combining
overrated.
That with Lil Jon, doing that sort of crunk thing, bringing it into his world. That's when Usher really stepped up as a distinctive artist. And I think Chris Brown is going to have the same trajectory. He's only on his second album. He's only 18 years old. I think by the time this kid's in his early to mid-20s, he's going to be making great records.
So I said
this
buy
is
it.
Not a great record.
I said buy it, you're saying?
I'm saying this is a burn it record.
The truth I believed has a way of interfering with what
Greg, those are the lush and lovely sounds of the duo known as Damon and Naomi. That's Damon Krakowski and Naomi Yang, husband and wife. Used to be the rhythm section of a band called Galaxy 500. Has seen many imitators over the decade and a half since they broke up in the 91, I guess. Founders of the slowcore movement. Peaceful, droning, hypnotic, psychedelic rock. You've seen a lot of bands follow in that wake, including Luna, which Dean Wareham led. Damon and Naomi have been on their own ever since, and they have just released what is, I believe, their sixth studio album, Within These Walls. This is a really interesting duo. They run a publishing company, and they run their own indie label, and every year and a half, 2 years, 3 years, they put out a really good record. I think Yola Tango gets all the attention for being the great husband and wife team of indie rock, Ira Kaplan and Georgia Hubley. I love them, don't get me wrong, but Damon and Naomi belong up there in the same realm, especially on the last couple of records where they've been collaborating with the great Japanese guitarist Michio Kurihara of the psychedelic rock band Ghost. He's come in and added guitar to their gentle folk sounds, and they write beautiful songs, songs about relationships, songs about, you know, impressionistic views of the New England countryside, stuff that draws deep on poetry. Okay, what's different about this album? They've made it even a bigger sound, bringing in some saxophone, bringing in cello from some of the members of that band Espers, which is a big part of the freak folk scene. Well, Damon and Naomi touch on that. They go deeper in a more old-fashioned way, something like Fairport Convention, maybe, incredible string band. They were listening to a lot of Frank Sinatra
when they were trying to craft the sound on this album, they noticed that throughout his most productive years, the chairman of the board put out two albums a year, every year. One was the happy album, and you could tell because he was smiling, and one was the sad album, but they both had similar lush productions. They set out to try to replicate the sound, they've claimed, of a sad Frank Sinatra album. We'll talk about whether they succeeded or not after we play this tune. It's called The Well by Damon and Naomi on Sound Opinions.
It was broken, and I saw with my own eyes. I never knew that the water could rise so very high. There was a time I the time it was otherwise. There was a time that the water didn't rise and rise.
A song called The Well from the new Damon and Naomi record, Within These Walls. Jim, you're absolutely right. They are fleshing out their sound in a way that has not occurred before in their 15-year career. Their previous records all sounded like bedroom recordings, very intimate, but not particularly expansive. This record with the brass and with the string section, we've got them coming out into the world. It sounds like a chamber pop record instead of a bedroom record.
Mm.
I love the sound on that particular song that we just played, The Well. I think the addition of Kurahara, the guitarist, has been huge for this band, and I love the way his guitar curls around Naomi Yang's voice. It reminds me a lot of those really austere English folk records that Richard Thompson was doing with Sandy Denny in Fairport Convention.
Absolutely.
I love that sound. The string and brass arrangements, I'm a little split on. I love the string sounds. I love most of the brass sounds. And I got to say, I respect Bob Rainey a great deal as a saxophonist. I've listened to a bunch of his records. He's a supremely gifted avant-garde saxophone player. But there are moments on this record where I think, is this guy emulating Kenny G or something? I mean, the soprano, the soprano sax stuff is just a little sickly and a little too pretty. I wish he'd sort of soured it up a little bit, made it a little bit more keeping with that sort of eerie mood that this record sets.
But that's a contrast to
it's
the fact that...
It's a little too pretty.
No, but Damon and Naomi are aware of the fact that they are true DIY underground musicians. Neither of them has particularly great voices. Neither of them are instrumental virtuosos. But they're creating this music, and I think that their amateurism plays well off of Rainey's obvious accomplishment. I mean, this guy's a virtuoso, as you said, an underground great. Look, I don't think they've ever made a bad move, and I don't think that people are even aware of them. You know, certainly you should go back and buy the Galaxy 500 box set, because that's a must-own, brilliant record. And I think that the half dozen records that these two have made are way under the radar and deserve to be better known. They're all beautiful. I would give this one a buy it, as I would virtually everything they've done.
Well, You know, I'm not disagreeing with the bite. I'll give it a bite as well. You take that saxophone out of that, out of this thing, and it'd be about a perfect record. There is don't get me wrong. There's a lot of beauty on this record. I just have that one quibble. I got to say, every time I hear that soprano saxophone, I cringe.
But that's saying a lot. You're buying it anyway, despite the cheesy sax.
It's beautiful. I mean, they have exquisite taste.
You're just surly because you're cold. That's what
taste.
It is.
No, I just hate soprano saxophone, right, I guess, unless Wayne Shorter's playing it.
All right, Greg. What do we got next week?
Next week, Jim, we have, I think, an extraordinary opportunity to interview Tori Amos, who is, as you well know, one of the most eloquent musicians out there. And we had a chance to sit down with Tori in the Jim and Kay Maybe studio, and that interview will air next week.
All right. We've got some thank yous to say, as always. Our new pornographer's performance and interview was recorded by Sarah Toulouse and Mary Gaffney. And Sound Opinions is, as always, produced by Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, Robin Lynn, and our intern, Dave Mahler. With our executive producer, our fearless leader, our lover of cheesy soprano saxophone, Tori Southside Malatia.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. Now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Messages.
Yes, this is Rich from Japan. I just listened to your talking about a study that relates to file sharing increases purchases. These are the most ridiculous arguments. The fact is, as an intellectual property lawyer, I have to say, stealing is stealing. This is the same argument that says when legal immigrants come into America, they pay taxes and they work hard. Following an illegal act is a legal act, is meaningless. The fact is that copying is stealing. When I was in college, we used to make tapes of albums that we made of friends we knew, but that's different from putting music on the internet for distribution so millions of people could copy it. And the fact is that the study is meaningless, and like I said, the fact that you follow an illegal act, copying, with a legal act does not make the first act legal. Anyway, my name is Rich, and that's it. Bye.
Stella was completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating as a trip from town to town. Feels though nobody cares if I let watch I. So I might as well begin to put some action in my life. Breaking the law, breaking the law.
Thank you. My name is John Shepherd. I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Just wanted to thank you for the report on the University of London study on downloading. It vindicated me, actually, on what I've been telling people since Napster was shut down in the early part of 2001, I guess it was, that I've actually ended up purchasing more CDs from the things that I heard, and hopefully the rest of the music industry will get wise to the fact that file sharing and MP3s and downloadable samples are the wave of the future, and we'll see what happens. This will be an interesting trend to follow, but hopefully the big wigs will get wise to this, what we've been trying to tell people since the beginning. Thank you so much for your show.
Hey guys, this is Lisa calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Jim, I just wanted to call and let you know that this past week you finally restored my faith in your Desert Island Jukebox, because before then I probably would have taken my chances with the Sharks rather than spend the rest of my days with the likes of Portishead and Rush and ugh. But Only Shallow is hands down one of the best songs of all time. I almost called it in when you did the best lead-off track show, but didn't get to it, but I just remember being 10 years old and sneaking into my older sister's room when she wasn't home and secretly sampling her CD collection. And the day I put on Loveless, it was like one of those cartoons where the person's eyelids snap up and spin around like window shades during the opening notes of Only Shallow. think it's maybe a little too much for a 10-year-old's mind to handle, but wanted to thank you so much for a fabulous pick, and look forward to more selections that I would, you know, choose above a gruesome mauling death. So thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.